If you love the History Extra podcast, make sure you follow us to keep up to date and get all the latest episodes. Thanks for your support, and I do hope you enjoy this episode.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
Whether you're making a delicious family meal or a post-workout snack, choose the farm-fresh taste of Eggland's Best Eggs. Only Eggland's Best hens are fed their proprietary all-vegetarian feed. That's what makes their eggs more nutritious. With 10 times more vitamin E, 25% less saturated fat, and 6 times more vitamin D compared to ordinary eggs. Eggland's Best. Better taste, better nutrition, better eggs. Visit egglandsbest.com to learn more.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code SPOTIFY for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
It needed over 500 animal skins to produce each book, because the animal skins were treated to produce the parchment that the text of the book was written on.
That was Claire Bray talking about the Anglo-Saxons.
Listening to the History Extra podcast from BBC History Magazine. We're the UK's best-selling history magazine, available in print and several digital formats all over the world. Find out more at historyextra.com/subscribe or look out for us in your digital newsstand or app store.
Hello and welcome to the History Extra podcast. I'm Rob Attar, the editor of BBC History Magazine. The British Library's Anglo-Saxon Kingdoms Art Word War exhibition has opened in London to rave reviews. Medievalists have been swooning over the gathering together of a wealth of rare, beautiful and valuable manuscripts, books, letters, charters and artefacts from the 5th to the 11th centuries. Dr. Claire Bray is the British Library's lead curator for the exhibition, and BBC History Magazine content director David Musgrove met up with her on the opening day of the exhibition to talk through the display.
I'm here in the British Library and I'm joined by Claire Bray, the lead curator of the Anglo-Saxon Kingdoms Art, Word and War exhibition, which runs from 19 October to 19 February 2019. I've had a wander around. I was treated to the press view just now, and it's an amazing thing. So congratulations, Claire, for setting up such a fantastic exhibition. The first thing I just really like to know is, from you, you've been involved in setting this up, give me a sense of what it is like to hold one of these thousand-year books that you've got in the exhibition. What does it feel like? What does it smell like? What is it like to hold something like that?
Well, I've worked here at the British Library for over 20 years now, and I have to say, I think the experience of holding a medieval manuscript in your hands, for me anyway, it is
just always incredibly exciting. And I think that's one of the wonderful things about medieval manuscripts is that they have this amazing ability to transport you back to the world and the characters and events of the past. And that excitement never goes away for me. So that's what it feels like emotionally. But the manuscripts in the exhibition are, as you've seen, incredibly different in shape and size. The majority of the manuscripts are books, but we also have quite a lot of single sheet documents in the exhibition. You'll have seen we've got the earliest surviving charter that was written in England in the 7th century and the earliest surviving original letter from right at the beginning of the 8th century. But the books, some of them I can hold in one hand, the St. Cuthbert Gospel that the library acquired in 2012 following our really big £9 million fundraising campaign. It contains just the Gospel of John. It was made at the beginning of the 8th century and it is famous because it is the earliest intact European book. It's got a wonderful dark red decorated goatskin leather binding. As I say, I can hold it in one hand. And we are displaying it just next to Codex Amiatinus, which is a giant manuscript of the whole Bible that was written just around the same time as the St. Cuthbert Gospel in the early 8th century and in the same place at Wearmouth Jarrow, which was Bede's monastery. And at that time, most biblical manuscripts circulated as gospel books or as psalters. It's really unusual to have a whole Bible, but Chelfrith, who is the abbot at Wearmouth Jarrow, commissioned the production of three giant Bibles. One is lost. One, we have a few leaves remaining, which are here in the British Library, and the other one survives intact as Codex Amiatinus, and it is, as you've seen, it is a giant. It has over 1,000 parchment leaves, so over 2,000 pages of text. The spine of the book is over a foot thick to accommodate the whole text of the Bible. And it was, as I say, made in Northumbria, beginning of the 8th century, taken to Italy as a gift for the Pope, and ended up in Tuscany, and it has never been back to England in over 1,300 years. So we're absolutely thrilled to have it in the exhibition.
And, I mean, you're right, that is a behemoth of a book. I was amazed at how big it is. We'll come back to the, okay, to the Codex in a bit, if you don't mind.
Yeah.
But give me a sense of how difficult it is to produce an exhibition like this. You've got, I don't know, how many artefacts and objects?
There's 180 objects, okay, altogether, yeah.
And they've come from all over the place. So, you know, you've got the Codex Amiatinus, which has come from Italy and
yeah,
which presumably was quite a difficult thing to secure. So
yeah,
give me a sense of, it must be extraordinarily difficult to pull together, yeah, a collection like
so,
this.
80 of the exhibits in the show are drawn from the British Library's own collections. And the library has, as perhaps you might expect, the greatest collection of Anglo-Saxon manuscripts that survives, and many real treasures such as the Lindisfarne Gospels, illuminated manuscript made around 700 at Lindisfarne, and the unique manuscript of Beowulf, and many, many other treasures. So I suppose that's the core of the exhibition, being able to draw on the library's own collections.
That's a handy starter.
Yeah. But then the other 100 objects in the exhibition, which include archaeological discoveries as well as other manuscripts, are borrowed from 25 different lenders from across the UK and from many lenders in Ireland and continental Europe. And we have one loan of two manuscripts has come from New York as well. So, yeah, it's a very big task pulling together an exhibition like this. But I think
one of the most exciting parts is going to visit lenders and persuading them to lend, or in the case of this exhibition, persuading them to lend either their greatest treasure or, you know, some of their greatest treasures. And I think with this exhibition, once I'd started working on it a bit and had a few lenders had committed major things, then other lenders started to see that this really was going to be this once-in-a-generation exhibition, and that this was an opportunity to lend their collection items to a show which, you know, just wasn't going to be seen again for a very, very long time.
So, so you've had to pull on a network of contacts around the world to get these this material. So,
yeah, I mean, well, some were, you know, approaching libraries and collections where I already knew curators or librarians, and others were approaching institutions, you know, where I didn't know the staff. But so, yeah, trying to explain what the exhibition was about, what we were trying to achieve, was really key.
And in a way, that pulls on one of the themes within the exhibition for me, I think, and hopefully for you, is that it's explaining that the Anglo-Saxons operated within an international context and weren't just an isolated bunch of people on this small island.
So yeah, of course. I think. I mean, I think all societies interact with the societies around them, but that is something that we did want to show very much. We want in the exhibition, we want visitors to encounter the original evidence for the history and the literature and art of the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms, but to really see that through that evidence that the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms were deeply connected with Ireland and with continental Europe, both the, you know, the near continent stretching to Scandinavia down to Italy and Rome and the Mediterranean, through migration initially, because clearly the Germanic-speaking Anglo-Saxon peoples that came to Britain came from the continent, but there was travel, you know, religion through contacts with Rome, the initial mission in 597 from Rome to Kent, and the also missionaries coming, Irish missionaries coming from the Irish-founded monastery on Iona over to Northumbria. Those missions came in one direction, but they were just the start of, you know, long-term contacts with both Ireland and with Italy and Rome. There was a lot of trade. There were political contacts, the Viking invasions, the conquest of Canute in 1016, and, of course, the conquest of William of Normandy in 1066. So there were all sorts of connections. And I think one of the other key things is the role of manuscripts themselves and the people who produced them in, you know, those exchanges. So manuscripts are obviously portable objects. And as I've already said, one of the exciting things about the exhibition is bringing back manuscripts which have travelled to other parts of Europe, bringing them back to Britain for display in this exhibition, sometimes for the first time. But manuscripts moved. We have manuscripts going in the exhibition that went to France and Francia, and from Francia back to England. And there's evidence of artists and scribes being itinerant and moving around as well. So it was a, you know, it was an interconnected world.
Yeah, so there was a lot of sharing of ideas, and you can see that through the through some of the manuscripts. I wonder if you can help us a bit there, because most people, we don't have the paleographical or the linguistic ability to be able to read the Old English or the Latin that these fantastic texts show. So how should we understand them? You know, short of going on an Old English course, how should we you know, take something from looking at these documents?
Well, I think many of them are just incredible works of art, which, you know, it's very... They're spectacular to look at, and the artistry of the, say, the manuscripts in the section on the Golden Age of Northumbria show very clearly artistic connections both with Irish artistic traditions and with continental and Italian, Roman ways of decorating manuscripts. But we've tried in the exhibition to translate key passages and to give people ways into the manuscripts. In the literary section, you can listen to extracts from the unique manuscript of Beowulf, the greatest literary relic of the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms. You can listen to extracts being read in Old English and being read in translation, and also for the Sermo Lupi, the Sermon of the Wolf of Wulfstan later in the exhibition. But I think, those connections, they do run all the way through the exhibition, and it is definitely a key theme. And right at the end of the exhibition, we have three psalters, which are like a coda, really, and a grand finale. The first is the Utrecht Psalter, so-called because it's now held in Utrecht University Library. But it was made in Francia in the first half of the 9th century, and it contains the whole book of the Psalms, and it is full of incredibly lively line drawings illustrating what is going on in the Psalms, and it was a new way of illustrating the Psalter, and the drawings are in sort of strips, like a strip cartoon. So this Frankish manuscript was brought to England and was in Canterbury by about 1000 AD. And in the first half of the 11th century, a copy of it was made based on this model. A different script was used, and the style of the drawings reflects 11th century Anglo-Saxon style of drawings, but the layout of the text and what is depicted in these strip cartoon-like drawings is reproduced. So you see very directly, I think, between those two manuscripts, the connections and influence of this Frankish manuscript on what has been done in Canterbury in the 11th century. And then the third manuscript of this trio is the Eadwina Psalter, which is on loan to us from Trinity College in Cambridge, which is an even bigger manuscript than the other two. And in that manuscript, they changed the layout of the text. So it still reproduces the design of the drawings, but it's differently laid out. And instead of just having one Latin translation of the Psalms, it has the three different Latin versions of the Psalms. And between the lines of one of those Latin translations is an Anglo-Norman French translation of the Latin Psalms, reflecting the new reality of the Norman conquest. And between the lines of one of the other Latin translations of the Psalms is a translation into English, showing, you know, this manuscript was made in about 1150, and it shows the continued use of English after the Norman conquest, and the origins of the English language and the continuation of its use is one of the key themes of the exhibition. And, you know, English language is, I think, the greatest legacy of the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms.
And I agree. It was stunning to see those three psalters together. And I would imagine that it's the first time for the first two have been together since their Canterbury days for quite a while.
I think there was one exhibition on the continent when they were actually displayed together. But the Utrecht Psalter stayed in England until the early modern period, and then made its way to the Netherlands, but hasn't been displayed in an exhibition in Britain. before and hasn't been back to Britain for several hundred years. So it's certainly the first opportunity to see those three manuscripts together as a trio in Britain.
The other aspect to the exhibition that I was interested in was the sort of the multimedia sense, in a way, in that you've got a fabulous bit where we've got some metal mounts at the start of the exhibition, which have artistry, which is very similar to the Book of Durrow, which
right.
you showed. And so it's not just that the art is confined to these manuscripts, it's actually you've got other objects which show the art, the Ruffwell Cross, right. for instance. So can you tell us a little bit about how the art crossed between those boundaries?
Yeah, so we were very keen with the sort of archaeological objects that we have in the exhibition, partly, I think, to showcase new discoveries that have been made, you know, in the 21st century, things like the Staffordshire Hoard and the Lichfield Angel and the Windfarthing Pendant, but also to, use these objects which, you know, show unbelievably sophisticated craftsmanship, and to show the links between the motifs on the metalwork and the motifs in the manuscripts. And as I was just saying, manuscripts are portable, but metalwork is incredibly portable. They tend to be smaller objects. And the Book of Durrow is closely related to some of the metalwork. You mentioned those two mounts from Hochwald that have very similar decoration on them. And, of course, in the exhibition we have the Sutton Hoo gold belt buckle, which the British Museum has very generously lent to us. And there are the decoration on the gold belt buckle from Sutton Hoo is very similar to some of the decoration in the Book of Durrow, so much so that in the past it was thought that the Book of Durrow was probably a Northumbrian manuscript, but now it's thought that actually the similarities reflect the portability of metalwork, and there is other evidence from an inscription that suggests that the Book of Durrow was actually in a Columban monastery from a very early date and was probably either produced at the monastery of Durrow in Central Ireland, or that it reached there from the Irish-founded monastery of Iona off the west coast of Ireland, perhaps reaching Durrow via Kells.
This episode is brought to you by Indeed. We're driven by the search for better, but when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/History Extra. Just go to Indeed.com/History Extra right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
We don't always realize just how much our negative thoughts and experiences stick with us and weigh us down. You may find your brain constantly running through a highlight reel of bad moments. That comment your friend made last week that hurt your feelings. That frustrating thing your mum does. Or that silly thing you said in a meeting. Maybe it's time to get it all off your chest. Whether it's a tiny annoyance or something much bigger, talking about it can give you some relief and lead you to a potential solution. That's where therapy comes in. It's a safe space to share whatever's weighing you down and learn to process it so your internal highlight reel can focus on the good stuff. And BetterHelp offers affordable online therapy on a schedule that works for you. Connect with a licensed therapist by text, phone, or video call. Start the process in minutes and switch therapists anytime. Let it out with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/historyextra today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/historyextra.
Life is a highway, and on it there will be many chicken sandwiches. But there's only one McCrispy, so go ahead and hit the turn signal if you know about this juicy gem of a detour.
I said that I wanted to talk a bit more about the Codex Amiatinus. As I said, I was amazed at just the sheer size of that thing. Can you give us a sense about what was happening in Jarrow, Wearmouth at the start of the 8th century for that to even be considered to be a thing that was created? I mean, you would kind of imagine that, you know, it's the Dark Ages. People used to talk about that up there in the northeast. What was going on in those twin monasteries
I think a lot of people do think of this period as the Dark Ages, and one of the things that we're really trying to show is the sophistication of the artistry and intellectual life and literary and political culture of the period. But up at Wearmouth Jarrow, I mean, these were two monasteries that were founded in the 7th century. And following their foundation, Benedict Biscop went to Italy and brought back many books to Wearmouth Jarrow and built up there an incredible library. And Wearmouth Jarrow was an incredibly important intellectual centre, as was the Canterbury School, which was founded by Archbishop Theodore and Abbot Hadrian at Canterbury. And so these two centres were incredibly important. And of course, Wearmouth Jarrow was Bede's monastery. Bede was teaching and working and writing there and, yeah, drawing on this incredible library that had been built up. And I think it's also important with Codex Amiatinus just to think about the sort of practical resources that were required to produce it, because Abbot Chelfrith commissioned the production of three giant Bibles, and they have over 1,000 leaves in each one, so over 2,000 pages of text, and each leaf is half of a bifolium, so it needed over 500 animal skins to produce each book, because the animal skins were treated to produce the parchment that the text of the book was written on. So that's 1,500 animals whose skins need to be prepared and treated to make the parchment, to make the books. And then the pages have to be ruled, and the teams of scribes have to set to work copying the text of the Bible. So it really was a very, very complicated and process and a big undertaking for the monastery to produce these three books. And one was for Wearmouth, one was for Jarrow, and the third one, Codex Amiatinus, was the one that was taken to Italy and that we are so excited to welcome back in the exhibition.
I mean, that's phenomenal, the way you describe it, the amount of work that would have to contribute. Why would you create such a massive tome like that? What is that? Is it just to glory in God, or why so big?
Well, I'm sure they were aware that they were this sort of intellectual powerhouse up at Wearmouth Jarrow. And, I mean, most biblical manuscripts circulated as gospel books or just as Psalter. So it was very unusual to have manuscripts of the whole Bible. And, I think it reflects the importance of that centre at Wearmouth and Jarrow. And, they're sending quite a powerful message to the Pope, I think. It's a pretty amazing present to receive. Although Abbot Chelfrith took the Bible himself with a large party of monks, but he sadly died en route in Burgundy. But we know from other sources that the Bible does seem to have reached Rome, but then it was later in the monastery of Monte Amiata in Tuscany and stayed there till the monastery was suppressed in the 18th century. And it was at that point that it made its way to the Lorenziana Library in Florence, which is its home today and which has so generously agreed to lend it to us.
We should all be grateful to them for that. We don't know what the Pope thought about the gifts.
Sadly not.
That's a shame, isn't it?
Must have been impressed.
the poster for the exhibition on the wall highlights that it's 600 years of history that we're talking about. So that's a long old time. Do you think that the that it's reasonable to talk about this period in as a cohesive thing as the Anglo-Saxon period? I mean, that's just, you know, historical nomenclature, isn't it? But is there continuity in the artistic styles through the period that makes it seem sensible?
The artistic styles change an awful lot. I mean, it is an incredibly long period, and I often think about that, the sort of telescoping of time that tends to happen when you look back. And, you know, these 600 years of history were a very long time and a period. There was a lot of continuity, but there was an awful lot of change. And, you know, 600 years is from, like, now stretching back to the time of Henry V, you know? And it really, really was a hugely long time, you know, and starts off with these Germanic groups settling and forming their new communities, and then gradually there's a large number of small kingdoms being established, which then in turn gradually coalesce into larger kingdoms, and Northumbria, or Kent is powerful, Northumbria becomes more powerful, and then Mercia under King Offa, and then of course the West Saxons under Alfred and Athelstan. And Alfred starts off his reign as king of the West Saxons, but during his very powerful reign, it turns into the king of the Anglo-Saxons, and Athelstan, his grandson, consolidates that role as king of the Anglo-Saxons. But in some of his charters, you know, he's called King of Britain. And then you get a shift later on, moves from being king of the Anglo-Saxons to being king of the English and King of England, and that consolidation of the Kingdom of England under King Edgar, whose reign saw a lot of reform in the church, which in turn bolstered his own authority and the unity of his kingdom, was incredibly important. But then the Kingdom of England was conquered by Canute of Denmark in 1016. It's the anniversary today, actually, of that battle. So, and then, you know, you've got the rest of the 11th century leading up to the conquest by William of Normandy in 1066. So, yeah, it's an evolving picture, changing picture all the way through. But I hope that the exhibition conveys that change to visitors.
And you finish with the Doomsday Book, 1086.
Yes. It's our oldest public record Doomsday Book, and you know, I think it's really famous with the public for being this sort of monument to the control and efficiency of the Normans. But actually, Doomsday Book, or the survey that underlay Doomsday Book, was only possible because of the quite developed structures of organising England that had been developed in the late Anglo-Saxon period. So the shires, the counties, emerged in the late 10th century, and the boundaries of those shire counties existed until local government reorganisation of 1974. So they had a very long life, and those counties and their subdivisions of the hundreds, or the wapentakes, were the structures that used for tax collection and for administration of justice. But because they were in place that the Doomsday commissioners were able to draw on the geld records, the land tax records that the tax collection system had generated, and were able to go around the country and gather supplementary information that is at the heart of Doomsday Book. And Doomsday Book really is a mine of information about the organisation and the wealth of late Anglo-Saxon England. And it's, you know, it is that organisation and wealth that made Anglo-Saxon England so attractive to Danish invaders earlier in the 11th century and to the Normans in 1066. It was an attractive country to go and try and conquer.
The artistic consequence of 1066 was, as we talked a little bit earlier, the Bayeux Tapestry was, you know, came out of that. Forgive me if I missed it, but you didn't have much on the tapestry in the exhibition.
No.
Was that big? Clearly, it's a tapestry. It's in Bayeux at the moment. And was that because you're holding powder for something for when it possibly comes over in a few years, or did it not quite fit into the narrative you were looking at?
Well, I don't know whether you noticed there was a graphic in the exhibition of the battles of Hastings depicted in the Bayeux Tapestry to complement the couple of the manuscripts on display, which are looking back to what has happened in 1066. But yes, I think the negotiations over the loan of the Bayeux Tapestry are still ongoing, as I understand it.
And two more quick ones. What's your favourite object in the exhibition?
My favourite object is definitely Codex Amiatinus. Yeah. It was, everybody told me it would be impossible to borrow it. So seeing it arrive last week during the installation of the exhibition was quite an emotional moment, really. And I really hope that visitors to the exhibition will enjoy seeing it and encountering this great treasure of Anglo-Saxon England.
And was there anything that you really wanted to get in the exhibition that you were unable to secure, or is there anything, you know, in a dream world that would have made it complete?
Well, I think we have drawn together an amazing array of treasures from. You know, six centuries of the Anglo-Saxon kingdoms. I mean, obviously, we weren't able to borrow the Rothwell Cross, which is a more than 5 metre high stone cross, which has inscriptions in runic characters of extracts of the Dream of the Rood poem. So, but it is, you know, in situ in a church, the Church of Rothwell in Dumfriesshire. So what we have done is create a replica of that cross, which is, I think, an incredibly dramatic centrepiece. And it is actually almost right in the middle of the exhibition, but it's a centrepiece of the very large section that we have on the language and literature of the Anglo-Saxons.
Yes, and it does indeed look amazing. Claire, thank you. The exhibition is open now and finishes on the 19th of February. Tickets are available from the British Library website, bl.uk, and there are lots of special events going on as well, which you will find on that website too. So do go and have a look. Thank you, Claire.
Thank you.
That was Claire Bray. Anglo-Saxon Kingdoms, Art, Word, War runs at the British Library until the 19th of February next year. And it's best to book tickets in advance. You can find out further details at bl.uk. And for more on the Anglo-Saxons and our roundup of this particular exhibition, visit historyextra.com. Meanwhile, you can read an article about the Anglo-Saxons, written by Michael Wood, in the November issue of BBC History magazine, which is on sale now. Look out for it in all good retailers and on many digital formats. And we've now come to the end of today's episode, but we will be back in a few days' time with more from the world of history.
Thanks for listening to this History Extra podcast, which was produced by Jack Fletcher. Do let us know what you think about this episode by emailing podcast@historyextra.com, and we might read out your messages in future editions. Alternatively, why not keep in touch via Twitter or Facebook, where you'll find us at History Extra. For more great history content, don't forget to visit our website, historyextra.com, which is full of history articles, quizzes, image galleries, and more. Plus, it's where you can download hundreds of previous episodes of this podcast.